This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for August 20th, 2019. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I'm glad you're here. Are you glad you're here? I hope you're glad you're here. I hope if you're not glad you're here that you will be shortly, as I believe I have said on at least one other occasion. So as I said was going to happen at the end of the last episode, I have now done a stream. Hey, I'm streaming. I did a Marie Kondo-style tidying of my Destiny 2 vault. It was silly and fun. There were a few technical difficulties. The wrong mic was getting picked up after Lucio joined, so the ASMR potential really is consigned to the first half. But yeah, I think it was a success. I think we'll be streaming more in the future. You can find the archive on YouTube. So today I am talking to Sean Hontani and Marina Kitaka of Analgesic Productions. Together they made Anodyne, Even the Ocean, and most recently Anodyne 2, Return to Dust, which is what we're mostly talking about in this conversation. It is a deeply beautiful game that I, as I say in the interview, I really just kind of can't shake. It's a tough one to talk about for a number of reasons that I think this interview does a decent job exploring. For one thing, as I say, it's utterly and entirely spoilable. So this conversation does contain spoilers, mostly the sort of elusive spoilers that will only mean anything to you if you've played the game, right? Like, we're talking about things in general terms. You'll know exactly what we're referring to if you've played, and if you haven't, it'll be a bit of a head-scratcher, maybe just evocative. If you would like to go in absolutely cold, then you can probably only listen to the first couple of minutes of this before doing so. Heads up, FYI. But it ends up sort of being a conversation about the spoiler dance and talking around things and trying to express stuff about a work that is so specific in its expressions that it's almost impossible to do that sort of second-order analysis. So it's a strange interview, but I think a pretty intriguing one, which is about the most appropriate thing possible for a game like this. So, you who are ready and perhaps even a bit hungry for something odd, enjoy. Anodyne 2 this week, and it's staying with me really hard. It's as with the first Anodyne, like I can't get it out of my head. Like I'm just walking around and I'm suddenly back in that place. It's really kind of beautiful. Cool. It's also imminently spoilable, like in terms of mechanics, narrative, whatever. So I think rather than trying to talk too much about what happens in it, I'd love to talk about just like what it is, how it feels to play it, the approach that you two have, which is I think really special. So maybe the right place to start is just, would one or both of you mind sort of describing what Anodyne 2 is?
Yeah, I think there's two ways we can describe it. Maybe like I can describe it from a gameplay standpoint and Marina can describe it like narratively.
Sure.
That's perfect, so, yeah.
Gameplay wise, it's kind of a game that combines different aspects of like dimensionality in games. So it's very much like an exploration through this sort of expansive feeling, but ultimately quite small and curated 3D world. And then it has this interesting kind of like spatial connection between 3D and 2D, because as you explore these 3D landscapes, you get to meet these characters who you shrink inside of and kind of explore these abstract 2D mini dungeons that kind of represent some aspect of that character. That's the general gist of the gameplay loop.
Okay, yeah. And I think it's fair to say that ties very closely to narrative.
Totally, totally. So, narratively, Anodyne 2 is a game about this character, Nova, who is a special type of being called a nanocleaner. And what that means is that she can travel around this world and find characters who are having problems with nano dust, which is kind of like this mysterious stuff that amplifies their kind of worst qualities or like negative emotions or ways that they're having difficulties. And so you shrink inside them and then you like do some stuff with like vacuuming and you find these dust crystals that are lodged inside them and suck them up. And so that's kind of the premise. And then as you, a lot of kind of what ultimately happens is like good to find out for yourself, I suppose.
That's perfectly fair. No, but that is definitely the setup. And it's, I think, fair to say a game about like scale, like it becomes, it's not giving too much away, especially for folks who've played Anodyne 1, to say that Anodyne 2 is very aware of itself as a game, very aware of you as a player, but also very committed to making its world believable or evocative or resonant or something, right? It sort of gets away from traditional ideas about like fidelity or suspension of disbelief or immersion or whatever, in order to create something that feels more like really memorable games feel, where there's just like these bits of emotion or beauty or whatever that lodge themselves in your brain. It's like surrealism with a capital S is sort of how I would describe it. It's more about a bunch of things that add up to a whole that sort of emerges naturally, rather than, you know, you being able to step back and necessarily see this grand design or something like that, or forget that you're playing a game or whatever other aspiration people talk about with fiction.
Yeah, I think the thing that makes the surrealism of Anodyne 2 work is that we have this like narrative through line guiding everything. Like, I think because we set up, so just a little bit more on the narrative, just since everything's kind of set up to like have Nova kind of thinking about her job and kind of reacting to that pressure. You know, we're able to use that character arc to kind of change the design of areas as time goes on to sort of like fit into maybe the kind of like loss of direction Nova might be feeling and those sorts of things. And I think that since we have this sort of main narrative through line in the game, it lets us kind of go off course very like extremely near the
that's fair getting, no, I hear what you're saying though.
Spoiler.
Spoiler, okay, stream, or is
it absolutely can be that, so I like totally leave it up
well,
to you,
just like, yeah, I think
if you would like to talk in a non-spoilery fashion and then have sort of an event horizon, you know, X number of minutes in, that's fine. But if you would rather we say, if you liked Anodyne 1, you will probably really, really like Anodyne 2. It's worth checking out. It's beautiful. Go play it. And then if you want to listen to a podcast about it, we probably need to say some things about it. Therefore, ye be warned.
Yeah,
I'm fine with that as well.
I think that's good. Because otherwise, I think, yeah, we are kind of limited in what we can say, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe. I don't know.
Let me say this. One thing it reminded me of, and I think part of what all three of us are struggling with a little, is it like reminded me of Undertale a bit. Not in that it plays anything like Undertale or that the tone of the story is like Undertale especially, but just in the sense that it sets up these expectations, part of which are sort of nostalgia-based or based in how old games looked or felt or something, and then immediately starts sort of messing with them. Sometimes in gentle ways, sometimes in jarring ways, whatever, but it doesn't just like stick with a baseline or even twist or escalate it in sort of a traditional game sense. Although I guess in Anodyne 1 you had a broom, now you have a vacuum. That's a classic escalation.
Yeah.
But it's more about sort of knowing what the player expects at a given moment and then, like, you know, sometimes just, you know, zagging when you might have zigged or something. But it uses
right.
that classic first day on the job narrative setup. You know, I'm Guybrush Threepwood and I want to be a pirate, as a license to go to all these crazy surreal places because everything is as weird to Nova as it is to you. And you know, what is normal is not a given or something.
Right. I think that's definitely, that's important to like in understanding how Anodyne 2, I guess, is effective as a game, because definitely that entire first, okay, so I think, you know, we just should just talk about spoilers. So the entire first like C note area, those first four characters, those are all set up in very like traditional ways, like problem solution, blah blah blah. And in the sense, I think that's kind of like, you know, easing someone into the swimming pool or something. Like, after that, you know, things start to change a bit. And then by the latter parts of the game, people are so, this idea of shrinking into people is very like bizarre and foreign at first. But by the end of the game, I think, you know, we're able to kind of just throw everything out the window. But, and then people still understand what's going on.
And it's very, very playful about narrative and just about structure, because like you said, those first four clients, those first four people who you clean are structured very much the same. You explore a 3D world in order to get to them, and then you the world inside of them, the interior world in both senses, right? Gameplay and narrative is a 2D world. It ends with a dust crystal, etc. Once you're inside, you never leave. And then those are the sorts of, like, every expectation I just said basically is something that the game, you know, messes with at some point, as far as whether you're starting at nanoscale or in the 3D world, as far as whether you stay in once you're in, like, it plays with what's going to happen in a bunch of different ways, which makes sense because Nova is learning more about how the world works and the implications of her job and all that.
Yeah,
it definitely sets up the expectations, because it's like not it was really important to do that, I think, because it's kind of a fantastical job and to begin with, and so it's kind of important to get the sense of like, oh yeah, like I get it, this is how this like works, this is how this game works, this is narratively how this character's job works. And it kind of also ties into Nova's character arc and Nova's experience, that those first four areas kind of really leave this intense impression that kind of comes back as she's going about the rest of the journey and kind of like having experiences that are more complicated and don't necessarily fit into that same mold. But because those were these like formative, kind of like in a sense early childhood experiences, that it's really hard to shake the idea that set up about what she's doing, even as things a lot more loose or confusing or going in different directions happen.
Yeah. I'm really glad you said early childhood, you know, because it is, if we're allowed to be a shade spoilery, I think it is a coming of age story in a certain sense. And it's about, you know, recognizing authority, specifically parental authority, and then wondering if that was all true and all that. So those first four are really like things that even as a little kid, you realize like, yes, there need to be rules to control these things. Things like anger, things like filth, things like, you know, being a slave to your desires or whatever. And of course, things get more complicated as you're out in the world and you see that people's problems don't map neatly onto like, I have a powerful emotion and I need to tamp it down. That isn't actually the solution to everything.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, and it's like it's a very like sort of clean through line, even as it's pretty abstract, and as like you said, you have this license to go in some crazy world building direction where every location has its own sort of like, it doesn't even matter whether it fits into the grand Anodyne lore, although there's plenty of stuff in there that connects to the first game and whatever. It's more just like every person you meet, every place you go to, is this opportunity to just reflect and feel and like take it all in. And it's, I don't know, it puts, these games put me in this wonderful headspace that,
oh, thanks,
a lot of games don't. Because games don't try to always, right? Like they're so interested in a believable world, and fans are often so interested in cohesive lore that you know, you eliminate a lot of opportunities when you need to be that sort of reined in. There's a freedom to the way you two work together, like in terms of the visuals and the audio and the writing and everything, that I just it knocks me out.
Yeah, I think some games like maybe over focus on like a few emotions and you know, they can pull it off quite well, but at the same time it's a limiting factor, I guess.
I'm so tired of feeling cool and badass. I never need to again.
Something I found interesting about Anodyne 2's story is that I think it's just there's a lot of like different ways you can read all of it, because it definitely, you know, definitely on the most surface, not surface, but like I'm kind of curious what the most common reading of it will be, but it definitely
sure, yeah,
can be read as a coming of age story. But I also see a lot of how I relate to it is I think a lot about kind of just the process after kind of like living on my own, just like of having various kind of like beliefs you grew up with kind of breaking down, you know, various ways of viewing the world kind of just changing and the spoiler, okay. But the sort of like the Dustbound arc of Anodyne 2 is really interesting because it kind of parallels a lot, for me at least, of meeting, you know, other people of color or meeting queer people or, you know, people from various identities that aren't necessarily in the majority, and kind of the various things you learn from them and perspectives and how they kind of challenge different like slices of authority. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that section, when I was the first thing that popped into my head, if you're collecting readings, when I was playing that section was faith, right? The idea of having a belief that you consider bedrock and then meeting someone who challenges your assumptions because they believe something different or because they live in a way that you were taught is categorically wrong, but you can't sort of see anything wrong with them, and what a head trip that can be, and how you work through it, and what a challenging, you know, failure ridden yeah. growing up moment that can be. Yeah, I didn't mean to say it was a coming of age story sort of callously, as though like it follows the classic John Hughes template or whatever. I didn't mean that. I just meant like that is there is narrative and thematic glue that, because like some surrealism is just a bunch of weird shit getting thrown at you, and there's nothing right. essentially wrong with that. But I think you have, like, even though meaning emerges organically and it happens as you go, it works best when some meaning does emerge, and then like what you're experiencing coheres around themes, and there is like an intelligible plot in Anodyne 2 that is organized around those themes, and I think that's important for some people to hear, and I think it's also part of what makes it special. It's not merely weird, you know.
Thank right. you. Yeah. Yeah. It's very. Yeah. I think that's kind of a contrast with Anodyne, the first one. Not that Anodyne didn't have organizing principles or was like only weird, but it definitely the cards are played closer to the chess kind of in Anodyne sure. 1, and that was something that I think like a lot of people really, really loved that, and like how it was just like a lot of these strong feelings that could kind of be explored and like tied to a person's own experiences in like a really kind of messy way. And a lot of people also didn't like it for it just being kind of too vague for them to latch onto. And
I was gonna say, when people can't find meaning, they assume there is none and sort of wave their hand and move on or something. Like that, there's a certain kind of player, reader, audience, whatever, that will do that. But
yeah,
some people cherish the unknown. I kind of do myself.
Yeah, so there is like a difference there, but I'm also curious to see how much of a difference people will feel, and kind of like how the reception will contrast, because it is like, there's very much more of a pretty set in stone, clear central plot line in Anodyne 2 in a way that there wasn't in the first game, but also a lot of very surreal and unexpected things happen along the way. And so I'm very curious to see, you know, will people be like, you know, like, oh, like it's not like the first one because of XYZ, or will they be like happy? Or I mean, obviously, everyone's yeah. there's going to be a range of reactions, yeah. but it'll be interesting to see how that range kind of feels, because I think a lot of the time, when each time we finish a game and like hear feedback and like kind of think about how we feel about it, about the game, that definitely has a big impact on like what we do moving forward. And so I'm very curious. Yeah. How what that range will feel like.
I don't know. I just have a list of like 20, like a bullet point list of 20 things that I think people will say that are will like be kind of like boring takes on the game. But
oh no, I hope I haven't done any of those so far.
No. It's not the kind of It's like kind of like the stuff you'd see in like flippant reviews.
Oh, sure. The sort of traditional game press thing of, you know, it doesn't quite capture the magic of, or whatever. Yeah, those sort of
not
stock phrases.
Not enough pixels. It's all a bit better.
It seems to me you chose the number of pixels pretty deliberately, but so that's the other thing, right? I mean, the maybe aesthetic elephant in the room we haven't talked about yet is this game has a look about it that not a lot of games have done so far. There have been some, right? But it's not an accepted look the way that pixel art, you know, 8 or 16-bit, or for that matter, less, pixel art is. It looks a bit like a PS1 game, but more to the point, it looks the way we remember PS1 games looking. It's got bigger.
Look at a PS1 game.
Right. Jump and Flash, is that what it was called? Didn't look like this because there was all this like distance fog and whatever. This is pieces. These have these big open vistas that were impossible on the old hardware, but they have the abstraction and like the super deformed aspect and the stuff that lets your imagination fill in the blanks in the way that, you know, photorealistic graphics don't always. It's got that stuff. It's got the feel of those games. Like Shovel Knight or whatever, right? It's not how those games looked. It's how I remembered them looking. I think you were a little less, for lack of a better term, strict about like Shovel Knight tried to respect the actual technical limitations of the hardware it was emulating in certain ways. They cheated in specific ways, whatever. This, I don't think, is that. This is really more just about capturing the look and the feel and the sound, for that matter, of an era, right?
Right. Yeah, it's more about... It was from the get-go, it was... it was pretty much about, yeah, taking kind of the visual techniques from that era and then seeing how we could use them with modern technology. And there's a lot of reasons too, so that's kind of the reason why we didn't respect like hardware limitations, because we don't really care about them. the game still is very like hardware friendly. Actually, you can run it on like 8-year-old laptops at 60 FPS on like some of the slightly lower settings, but you know, it still looks pretty good.
I would be interested to see the game at lower settings, actually. I'd like how different would it look? I'm sure.
Oh, not that different.
Yeah,
the shadows go away, and then the outdoor terrain kind of looks chunkier.
You've made a game that is potato mode proof. That's impressive in this day and age. Did you sort of build the tech behind it? More, I mean, it's like how much of this stuff is bespoke, right? Like I both on the graphical side, you know, Marina and Sean under the hood, like is this a bunch of tools built to emulate that kind of hardware, or is the stuff that you more or less like built from the ground up in order to get the feel you were going for? I've watched some of your Twitter development stuff, but I don't know too much about what's going on behind the scenes.
It's just like Unity. We don't really do anything fancy. Early on, we decided, you know, low poly, so every model Marina makes doesn't have too many polygons. What else? There's also just, because there's only one artist, you know, Marina has a limit as to how much, like, different objects can be made. But then the trickiest thing, maybe, like, was just deciding, the outdoors terrain... That thing in Unity can get pretty expensive, so we had to set some like limitations there, but it ended up being mostly fine. Although Unity terrain is like the hills and the mountains.
Sure.
It's kind of tedious to work with, but...
It uses open, empty space in a way that I found really compelling. And I think, Marina, you said in a previous interview that in early prototypes when you were thinking about basing it on a game you made or a prototype you made, there was like a third scale where you became giant to move quickly, and that became the ability to transform into a car. Which is, after all, exactly how you compress the scale of space in real life, right? It's like having a vehicle. So it's like it seemed like a really smart choice to me. But there is empty space. It kind of creates this. I think you said this in the same interview, that it creates the feeling that the world is not just your playground. It's not built around your abilities. It's a world that exists regardless of you, and there's stuff in it that you can do. I think it captures that feeling gorgeously.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I think possibly if you're thinking of, I did a podcast recently, and we kind of
Nice
talked
Games,
about,
I think podcast.
Yeah, Nice Games. But I actually work in the same co-working space as one of the people who is on that podcast. There's this organization / co-working space called Glitch in Minneapolis. So that's been cool.
That's super cool. But, I'll be sure to link to that.
Yeah. But we kind of talked about this idea of lo-fi and like what that meant to us. And for us, it was very much about, not about trying to match like the PlayStation or the PlayStation 2 or like a specific old console, but really like using the tools that we had right in front of us and like what is easy for us to do with these, what is like simple for us as creators, like what skills do we have. And so we really tried to use kind of simple, just like looking at like what's here in Unity, what's like what can I make in Blender. It's just kind of like learning how to use Blender. And so we use the Unity terrain, and I think I really like it aesthetically, but like Sean was saying, it's very tricky to use, and Yeah, you don't like have a lot of control. So it definitely like pushed a boundary where if I had wanted to do anything like even a little bit more complicated, like it would have been like started to push out of that realm of being efficient to use by being simple.
Yeah, like Unity terrain is, it's like if you want to build a small little slope, a precise slope, it's just like you're just shit out of luck. There's no way. I mean, you can try, but it's like it'll be 10 minutes later and you'll have a wrist cramp. And like, I mean, it's good for like broader strokes stuff, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's there is sort of 3D exploration is always going to be a little broken. I mean, like there's not for nothing or 3D speedruns. You know, like if you look at a Dark Souls speedrun, you know, someone's out of bounds for most of the run or something like that. There's something intrinsic to 3D that's about breaking it a little. So like some of that stuff worked for me, like some of the geometry being carefully crafted, but also a little bit like it's not the same as the 2D levels. It's not that like pixel perfect, you know, tile by tile kind of organization. Like I was able to get out of bounds one specific time, but it's like you knew I was going to get out of there maybe because there was something to find out there that was optional.
Yeah,
yeah, the game sort of acknowledges that, and I think it explicitly acknowledges what you're doing with scale. Like it's a game about scale in the sense that it's a game about a character who can shift size, but it's also a game about scale in that, you know, again, we're spoiling things minorly, but it's it talks directly to the player at a certain point about like, here's how we made a world without spending 10 years doing it. Like it actually sort of wears on its sleeve the circumstances under which it was created. So it makes perfect sense that you were using the tools that were ready at hand rather than trying to like make a PlayStation like engine from scratch or something crazy like that, because that's the spirit of the game, right? Like using what you've got to make something new and beautiful. You're about to hear a dog bark. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, mute myself here. Sorry.
Hello?
Hi, Sean.
Are you whispering?
How's it going?
I used to have two dogs.
Dealing with the aspiring guard dog here, sorry.
I used to have two dachshunds.
Oh, amazing.
They're cute, but now they're not alive anymore. Okay. It's kind of weird because right now I'm at my parents' home, and every time I walk downstairs, I always expect to hear the dogs bark, but they've been, you know, gone for like 8 years. It's kind of weird.
Do your parents want to get new dogs?
No, no one wants new dogs in the family. It was nice, but it just like, it's hard to like, I don't know, we're like half dog family.
Yeah. Half dog
family. We like half want a dog, but not enough to like, you know.
Yeah.
That's fair. I got these two rescue mutts, one of whom has been under the coffee table, the microphone's on the whole time. The other one is staring out the window. My wife and I just moved into a new house, and so they are A, extra defensive of it, and then like B, we don't have curtains yet, so like any time a package gets delivered or whatever, they're like, I get to pull my weight. I'm going to protect the homestead. Like so. Yeah. Anyway, sorry about that. Thank you for the dog banter. That's always appreciated. Yeah, okay, so where were we? So the game acknowledges the fact that it's a thing made by people, right? That's all of the stuff. I think Marina, again, you were on the Nice Games podcast, you were talking a bit about how to you lo-fi means taking all the quirks that a more polished, I'm wiggling my fingers, product might try to hide and making them part of what is beautiful about it. And I think like that exists at so many scales in this game, like the way you use tools that in some cases are new to you, the way that the game like, you know, picks up and throws away little aesthetic ideas and the way some of it's very lo-fi, but some of it's pretty lush, but in weird ways, it's really like a game about the act of creation in a certain way and about agency and creativity. And it's just, that element of it, I think, is maybe one of the things some of the flippant reviews you were talking about might miss, but that's going to make it really special to people, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, thanks for those comments. I think a lot of the streamers and fans are pretty much streamers. Some of the fans are streamers, so they've been playing, or QA testers. They've really, like, enjoyed everything, which is nice. And, I can kind of sense that sort of unique flair the game has.
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like some of the things that Sean is worried about won't happen too much. I mean, you know, there's always the random person, but like, I guess it's a way of being emotionally prepared ahead of time.
Sure. Anticipating. Yeah. I mean, you said you have a list of 10. That is a thing I do. If I'm anticipating negative comments about something I'm making, I'll actually say, all right, here are the possible objections. Here's the fun self-effacing way that I'll deflect them. like I totally do that too. So I understand it, but it's also, there's that sort of simpler element of, if you're making a sequel to something, even sort of a loose Final Fantasy-esque sequel, is I think how you sort of put it on the Steam page. Yeah. There's people who will like it simply for not being precisely like the original. which is a double bind, because if you made precisely the original again in some way, then you'd get shit for that. So, you know, there will be some people who aren't pleased unavoidably, but yeah, it's a beautiful game. Just like, that's all there is to it.
Yeah, it should be fine. I'm just more worried about like crashes.
Sure, fair enough.
I don't think the game crashes, because Unity is really good.
I experienced one crash in my entire playthrough. And I think it was my own fault, because I did like kind of a weird glitchy thing. Maybe this is actually useful to tell you, and if you don't want to spoil this part, I can cut this out. But it was the sort of, yeah, I'm going to jump in here and say that this would have been a bridge too far as spoilers. This is a genuinely surprising moment in the game that you deserve to be surprised by. So, yeah. We now return you to the thing you were already listening to.
All right, cool. Oh, yeah, it's funny. A QA tester mentioned that, and I was like, this is all going to happen, and then
what can I say? Anyway, maybe I will cut that out, because that is that the fact that that section exists is just bonkers.
That we can cut that out. Yeah, that's the
thank you.
Meeting the dolphin. I say meeting the dolphin.
That's what we call it. Meeting the dolphin. Have you met the dolphin?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's so okay. So other things I was reminded of, and that's not to say again that it's a derivative game. It's pretty out there and original. But some of the text overlay narration was kind of reminding me of Yoko Taro, like Nier Automata, and especially the first Nier. As just sort of this way of layering stories on top of stories, and this way of like not even breaking the fourth wall, but like denying that the notion of a fourth wall is even valuable, like really just like this direct neural link into the player's brain. I don't know if that at all was something in your head, but
I think the idea originally actually came from Luca. Which, have you played Luca?
I totally haven't. I just heard about it. It totally flew under my radar. I bought it on Switch yesterday, and as soon as we're done talking, I'm probably going to go play it.
The funny thing is that I got it from Luca, but Luca got it from Nier, and then I played Nier after that. I played Nier Automata, but I don't remember. I didn't think about it at that point, but I played Nier 1 and thought about it, and then I think we were both thinking of ways to save time on like cutscenes and animations, and it's a really good way, just using like prose, and also just, you know, reading prose also forces a lot of like visual imagination that might be hard to represent with detail, and also just like stuff written in dialogue boxes, like speaking in words, that's like just different from like description and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was really fun to write in prose. Also, what was that like game that you like with the green dinosaur thing?
It's a Japanese Nanatsu Kaze no Shimamono. Okay, never mind. It's a Saturn game, but
I don't know this game at all.
I'll say it's you can just search like, never mind. Nanatsu.
You're being self-conscious about pronouncing it correctly. Come on now.
Like... No. It's gonna be confusing. Nanatsu Kaze no Shimamonogatari. It's like a Saturn game.
Okay. And yeah, I'll find it and I'll link it in the bottom. Yeah.
It has like these like storybook overlays where it kind of like shows like single sentences over the whole screen to kind of like describe what's going on.
Inspired that when it does the partial fade screen.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that I'll for sure look that up. Because, you know, what I thought of was the first Nier, because it uses it a ton. It's interesting that, like, you got it from Luca, who got it from them, because I'll refer to one more thing from the Nice Games podcast, which is sort of the notion of double nostalgia. the idea that, you know, especially younger players now who are growing up on this current crop of like, I don't know, we're in this weird game renaissance right now where there's this new kind of creativity and awareness and whatever, you know, people are going to be nostalgic for Undertale, you know, even if they don't really know what Earthbound was. People are going to be nostalgic for Anodyne, even if the pixel art that it's drawing from is unfamiliar to them, if they don't know, you know, Link's Awakening or Link to the Past or something. That those kind of like second and third order ways that aesthetic ideas ripple through the culture are beyond interesting to me.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I hope that Luca and actually it's interesting because Luca was inspired by Anodyne.
Tight circle.
The designer's actually like a few years younger than us. The main lead designer, Colin. And he was a fan of Anodyne a lot, which was interesting. Because I don't know many big games that were like directly inspired by a lot of Anodyne. I know a lot of creators in like smaller games. But like in terms of like long form size, I haven't seen too many.
That like directly attributable. I don't know. I feel like after Anodyne, I saw like a spike in experiments in surrealism, just generally. Not that that's like 100% attributable, but that kind
of. That'd
be amazing. That dreamy quality, and that I think Marina, you've said in other interviews that the dialogue is just like in the Anodyne one. I mean, is just, you know, in some cases memorable conversations you had. Or remember hearing or something like that. That kind of style, that freedom, you know, that free spirit is something that I feel like I've seen more of lately. Like there, you know, again, shit's been weird forever, right? Like, I mean, I love me some Space Funeral and all of that. But I do feel like I've seen sort of a blossoming of people who are weird in incredibly specific personal ways. You know, like I get the sense that this game is personal for both of you, you know, like it, I don't think you're using the abstraction to distance things. I think you're trying to use it to get to something closer and truer.
Yeah, it definitely is very personal. And, I'm kind of excited about, like, I feel like it's, there's a lot of really cool, like PlayStation era games that, have so much going on that's very beautiful visually or like interesting ideas, but then like I think a lot of games on the PlayStation, because it was like early 3D just figuring stuff out, have like really bad controls and so they're just like so hard to play, or like just like different, like the wrong things kind of take too long, I don't know. And so it's fun to be able to kind of maybe have a bit more refinement in some of those more just kind of like practical considerations of experiencing a story, but be able to like play in similar spaces of like the weirdness that you can get with a lo-fi 3D world. And so, yeah, I think, like, on top of that, not just, like, on a mechanical level, but with the narrative kind of having multiple threads of both this, like, concrete central storyline and, like, the sort of episodes that you meet throughout the world, I feel like that's also a kind of a way of breaking down barriers of people like experiencing more like surreal stuff. I don't know.
Content is such a fraught word. On one hand, I like it because it like flattens it out, or like, you know, something I make and something the Disney Corporation makes are both just content. But on the other hand, it's so dry. You know what I mean? Like to say that Anodyne 2 has a lot of content in it is it just feels so clinical, when what we mean is it's this big sprawling adventure, you know?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is like a thing that I think about like a whole lot in the stuff that I make is like making things like kind of welcoming in a sense to, I like to like think that it's sort of like a lot of different people could experience it and like find something that is meaningful to them. And like the way that I like to do that is by thinking about like multiple like layers existing in the same space of something being satisfying on like both maybe simpler and more complicated layers at the same time. And so that's something that I'm excited about in Anodyne 2 that I think happens pretty well. And I'll see how people experience that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that worked incredibly well. Cause I mean, I think it does it better than anything else you two have done together, if I may say so. Cause I mean, like, I like Even the Ocean a lot. There's that choice right at the beginning though, where it's like, do you want the story? Do you want the gameplay or do you want both? And the fact that Anodyne 2 doesn't need to do that is I think a testament to sort of the design and the sort of the confidence with which it's designed. The idea that like that stuff is all of a piece, and if you want to do like a, you know, like a straight up, you know, quick playthrough, then it's very welcoming to that. If you just want to explore at your leisure, it's all about that. If you want to dig and understand the world, if you want to, I mean, okay, I'm going to spoil one more very small thing, but there's just a moment where the game sort of poses lore and meta as these like two dueling primordial forces almost, right? If you want to go hard on one or hard on the other, the game's inviting to that. And if you want to attempt a holistic view, which I did, partly because I like that and partly because I knew I was talking to you two, it's super inviting to that as well. I think it definitely is, more than any game I've played in quite a while, like it is welcoming. Is such a good word for all these different modes of engagement and play and just like all these different layers of understanding. It's like I said, it's sticking with me.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think
it's good to hear.
When we approach the meta stuff, we're definitely, I've been starting to think a lot about like the notion of like gray canon. There must be a technical term for this already, but like stuff that is in a work, but it's like, you can't really consider it part of like the canon story, or else, you know, and it's hard to give a straight interpretation, but you can kind of like choose to, you know, you can kind of incorporate it as much as you would like to in your interpretation. And I think that was what I was getting at with like that one meta info dialogue.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so yeah. There's this notion, there's a couple of notions, right? There's fanon, right? Like there's the idea that there are things that are not in the text that people who like it tend to accept to be true. And then there's the notion of like paratext, where like Dumbledore is not gay in the Harry Potter books, or at least the text doesn't confirm he is, but J.K. Rowling said so, so it's true, right? But this does something different, where like there's all this stuff in Anodyne 2 that is like in the text, but not in the text. It's like, what is the text even? It's like asking you to think about that on a certain level. Like, does it only count if it's in a dialogue box, or is anything contained within the game fair game, or why even stop there? Like, it's gray canon is an interesting way to put it, because what counts as being in the work, you know, like is director's commentary canon in the same way that the story is? Like, I think it's up for grabs. I think you can read different works different ways, and just getting people to think that it's possible to think different ways is kind of good. I would almost say important, because there is this sort of narrow, highly literal, diegetic reading that a lot of people take to all media that I think is just, you know, whatever. I don't think it's the death of intellect or whatever, but it's boring. And it's like it prevents people from enjoying and engaging with work as in the way that they could.
Yeah, the meta stuff is, it's pretty like fun, I think, because I think we were planning like post-game stuff like a while back, and I think Marina had the idea of like tying it to a character that already existed, or like any idea. I can't really remember what the order was, but basically like by tying some of these extra ideas more into the story, it both kind of does expand on the characters in the story, but also like not, I don't know where I was going with that, but basically
I know what you're saying though. Yeah, I mean, that was the other way
than if it was alone.
The other way that it reminded me of Nier is stuff you would think of as like as material you access after the game starts before the game is over. Like it starts creeping in when you're not done yet with the main path. I thought that was kind of, I mean, I don't know. I don't need to spoil the specifics. It can still be surprising when it happens, but I laughed out loud actually when like things started getting meta. I thought it was really effective.
Cool.
I feel like I'm just praising your game at you, and I hope you feel like
good to hear, like, speak about it with other people.
Yeah, no, and I'm not blowing smoke. It really was beautiful. And I know you said you had a pretty tight timeline, and I know you are a two-person operation, so totally understandable. Thank you again. I really, really appreciate you, you know, talking to me and being open and listening to me yammer about how good your game is. So thanks for that.
Oh, yeah. If you have any last questions, that's fine.
Yeah. Well, one thing I did want to go back to, you know, so you said that to you, the middle section of the game is very much about sort of experiencing people who come from a different place than you do, people with different racial backgrounds, or, you know, meeting a queer person for the first time, if you're not a queer person or something like that. Are there sort of specific ways in which, you know, your identities are intrinsic to the game in your heads, or is it a little bit looser than that? It's more about the idea of identities crashing into each other. You know, like, there's definitely stuff about gender in the game to a certain degree, but beyond that, it's all pretty, it's just a space to think about all of this stuff. Like, is there some aspect in which it's personal that you want to talk about that you don't want to just sort of like leave buried, which if you do, it's totally fine, that you feel like is worth knowing for someone who's already dug into the game a bit? Is it personal in specific ways that are sort of expressible in words, or is it that thing where like the game is the talking and that's not something you can really describe any better way?
I mean, it's definitely personal. I mean, it's personal, like, in all kinds of different ways. Certainly, like, there's a very direct reference in the way that the character of, like, Sea Psalmist is written. That is, like, Sea Psalmist has this kind of biblical and, like, religious way of speaking and thinking, sort of. And that's drawing on my own experiences and my own upbringing. And then, like, things get a little, like, still personal, but a lot broader, I think, when there's another C character who is brought on later.
Yes, fair enough.
And that has to do with other things.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel the need to ask specifically because, like, you know, again, there are themes the game wears in its sleeve, but this isn't, I mean, like, Sean, you made All Our Asias. Like, that is very much a game about race and about family and about intergenerational transmission of culture and how it's not simple, right? There's nothing in Anodyne 2 that's quite as direct as all that, although All Our Asias is still pretty abstract and all that stuff, right? But it's there's so much swirling around that, again, I don't want to make you make something literal that is beautiful because it's not literal, but I wonder, you know, like Marina, that was super helpful to understand, and I actually will go back and read some of that dialogue again because I'm curious, you know, to read it in a new resonance. But that's exactly it, right? Like, are there other things that were on your mind when you were building this world that you just sort of felt like you had to get out there, or was it more intuitive than that?
I think, at least for me, the portions that I got to write, I was thinking a lot about, you know, particular ideas that might have been fun to do in, like, small games or whatever, and or, like, stuff that I have been thinking about and then, you know, can't pursue as fully while in the middle of a bigger game. And so I was able to kind of, and then too, has a nice structure where you're able to kind of, like, create these little offshoot areas and then explore a different idea, but still kind of fit it into the general arc of Nova's cleaning and, like, development.
Yeah, I mean, I'll praise you both at you one more time and just say that, like, there are, you do that thing where it's like the Doctor Who writing staff talks about it. Like, if you blow an idea that's worthy of a feature film on one episode, you know you're doing your job or something, right? Like, you do that with levels and characters and stuff where you take the stuff that would be the premise of a whole game for other writers, and it's just like, it's this little pocket dimension that comes and goes. And it's really beautiful, and I really can't recommend enough that people check it out. If you liked the first one, or we should say, we haven't actually said, you don't need to play the first one to enjoy the second one or intuit it. The comparison to Final Fantasy is probably fair. It's a game with the same preoccupations and some some of the same preoccupations, but some through lines, but really just in the spirit, the idea of carrying on what made the first one interesting in a very different way. So if you didn't play Anodyne 1, Anodyne 2 is a totally good place to start, but Anodyne 1 is also great. And so is I mean, everything you two have made together has just really been beautiful. So again, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Have a good one.
All right, yep, see ya.
Bye.
And that's the show. You can find Anodyne 2 Return to Dust on Steam, Itch, GOG, Humble, and Cartridge. I highly recommend that you consider doing so. You can find Sean on Twitter at SEAN_HTCH. You can find Marina on Twitter at EVEN_KEI. And there's a link in the show notes to join the Analgesic Productions Discord, which would be a good time too if any of the preceding material sounded like your thing. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support at various scales from Francis Michelle Lopez, Lucio Valentino, and this week, Bowie, the not especially effectual guard dog. You can find the show on Apple, Stitcher, Google, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Breaker, and Radio Public, as well as pretty much everywhere else podcasts are a thing. And very exciting, this will be our first episode broadcast at nanoscale. You can also find everything we do at etao.blog and the podcast specifically at etaopod.com.